Welcome to Boston Basic Income. I'm Alex Howlett. This week's topic is fiscal versus monetary policy. Generally speaking, fiscal policy is the government's taxing and spending. The government pays for things that society needs, like roads, bridges, military, social security, etc. Monetary policy, on the other hand, is generally what the central bank does to influence interest rates in the financial sector and keep the purchasing power of the currency stable. Some of us read a May 2020 USA Today article by Brent Schrotenberg entitled U.S. is printing money to help save the economy from the COVID-19 crisis, but some wonder how far it can go. My question is, where does basic income fit in? Is it a form of fiscal policy? Is it monetary policy? Is it both? Is it neither? Is it something that makes sense to be implemented by the government or by the central bank? What is it? I've heard arguments from both sides on this, and I have my opinion, but first I want to go around and get people's thoughts. Where does basic income fit in the picture of monetary policy and fiscal policy? Go ahead, Neil.
I believe that basic income, as Alex has pointed out, should be probably implemented by independent, hopefully independent groups, because otherwise it would be very political. And I believe that basic income is basically a fiscal policy which is very useful at the present time. And whether it'll always be useful, I don't know. But basically, at the present time, we can print money at gazook and nothing untoward will happen. You could have economists arguing about why this is so, but my best guess is that what has happened is that the production of goods is very easily expanded so that we don't have a scarcity of the amount of goods that can be produced for all practical purposes. And therefore, we do not normally have the inflationary bias when we ask for too many goods. There is services, and I hope the whole services will get inflated a little bit because I think they get paid too little, most people in services. And so obviously at some point, even though we can produce almost all the capital goods that we really want, we will be bidding against each other for services. But in the present situation, it is very important that we pump money into the system. And the very easiest way to pump money into the system would be to set up a basic income. And that's my view.
Okay, fantastic. Let's go to Richard, Chance, and then Eddie. Go ahead, Richard.
In my view, it's both fiscal and monetary, because right now the economy is very weak because the current way we're getting our money, mostly through jobs. This past month, I think it said that half the amount of jobs that were expected to be created were not. That means that people are not able to access money. So we need a basic income in order for them to access money, which would potentially create more jobs. Unless we create more jobs, people are not going to have money to create more jobs. So it's just a vicious cycle.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Let's go to Chance, and then Eddie, and then Austin.
My struggle lately has been in relation to the is there a limit section of the article we read for today. A lot of people online, as well as scholarly M&T theorists, seem to think, at least on the surface, from what I can tell, that the government can simply print their way out of any resource deficit. They seem to be saying that we don't really need revenue or resources to fund projects at the governmental level. And my naive understanding, on the other hand, is that fiscal and monetary policy are just two ways governments can gather resources and revenue. And so either way you go about it, governments need resources and revenue to fund projects. So therefore, you can't simply print your way out of a resource deficit. I'm just here to get clarity on this and sort of explore this, what's often called the taxpayer myth about whether we need to get revenue from fiscal policy or not.
Good question. We'll definitely be getting into that. Let's go to Eddie and then Austin and then Bethany.
I think that the entire economic framework and understanding really needs to be revamped. So I think that UBI should really be an addition to the framework. It should be a form of monetary policy that works over the long term rather than over the short term as interest rates tend to. It was interesting that the article got into MMT and also the Austrian School of Economics. I think both schools are correct in feeling that there's something wrong with our mainstream economic understanding. And they both have kernels of truth in them. And they both also, I think, make mistakes.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks, Eddie. Let's go to Austin, Bethany, and then Derek.
Great comments so far. I agree with a lot of what people have said about the need for, you know, it is a stimulus now. Basic income is a stimulus, especially with what Richard and Eddie are saying in terms of what Richard's saying is sort of a bit of both, and Eddie saying that maybe the framework isn't really the correct way to look at it. I feel like the distinction between fiscal and monetary policy is a little bit overstated in terms of if you're trying to describe the real world, it doesn't really give you that much insight. And I think a basic income, it doesn't really matter which one it comes from, and that tells you something, I think.
Interesting thought. Does it matter which one it comes from? Maybe not. Let's go to Bethany, Derek, and then David.
A couple of things. One is that the two different ways of injecting money are not created equal in the sense that when the Fed injects money via like making credit easier, that can be more brittle than when you have other kinds of fiscal spending because people owe each other money in a sort of complicated way. And then if something happens and certain people can't pay, that can propagate down that line of people owing each other money, that kind of thing. So there are some downsides potentially to one over the other. In terms of what authority would manage the basic income, I kind of like Neil's idea of having yet an unimagined third authority or something like that. That's a bit like the Fed in attempting to be somewhat independent, but its job is the basic income. And then I'm sure Alex will get into this, but you can think of the different branches as responding to each other. I'm basically just plagiarizing Alex here again. So fiscal spending happens, whatever that does affects the amount of room you have for basic income, because imagine you spend a lot into the economy, there's a certain amount of resources that have to track that. And then maybe there's not as much left for basic income, or if fiscal spending is low, maybe there's more, et cetera. Then you can imagine the Fed responding to the combination of the fiscal spending and the basic income. So like how much money is already flowing is going to affect how the price level is functioning. And so the Fed can kind of pick up the slack there with interest rates, if that makes sense. So raising them if there's already a lot of spending from fiscal spending and basic income. I like that vision that Alex has put forth of how the three pieces would work together, whether they're three agencies or not. And I'm sure we'll get more into the constraints as people have raised. As I've been talking, you might have noticed I've been implying a certain constraint over the whole set of the three of them, which is the raw resources that we actually have, because if you pump more money towards the same production at a certain point, you'll get just price inflation, you won't get more benefit. That's how I think about the answer to Chance's question, that there is a constraint eventually because there's only so much that we can produce, at least in a given point in time. Maybe we can make it more efficient, that kind of thing. So I'm sure we'll talk a lot about that. But yeah, that's kind of how I see them. And I think it's interesting to think about that vision and then take the basic income piece away and think about what we have now without that. And the options are more constrained, right? You have government spending, which even that option often isn't used as much as the Fed, because people see it as spending in a more direct kind of way. And that can create pushback. And so then the Fed often, I think, picks up a lot of the slack. This professor primarily that Alex and I both like, who studies monetary theory, likes to say that when the Fed is being really bold, it might be because the fiscal authority isn't doing their job. They kind of have to try to scramble and keep things propped up. And so they're doing all these crazy things, like maybe buying more and more things and putting them on their balance sheet and keeping interest rates at zero and all these things. But it's because they have a limited set of tools and they can kind of operate independently. They don't have as much politics behind being able to operate. So they're not often as held back in that way compared to the fiscal authority. And so then they do all these crazy things trying to pick up the slack because the fiscal authority is deadlocked or whatever, which is certainly something that we've seen lately with the stimulus package.
Great thoughts. I especially like the question of what are the constraints that we face and which agencies are responsible for managing those constraints. Go ahead, Derek.
I think it's really useful to try to understand the distinction between monetary and fiscal policy in the traditional framework. I think you can get a lot of insight by really getting into that. At the same time, I think I've only gotten to the position where I'm comfortable talking about these terms and understanding how they work because I had the benefit of these more heterodox views, which are actually talking about the elephant of the room, which is, well, where does the money come from? How is currency issued? I like the article that we read because I think it raises all these important questions. And they point out, you know, it's not hidden, it's right there. They point out that the Fed, in order to uphold this restriction on monetary policy and sort of nominally lend money into the economy, they're creating the money that is lent. That's just something that happens, right? We sort of have to understand that. I think once you get into that, the distinction starts to blur a little bit, right? If the Fed is reacting as it needs to when Congress deficit spends and issues bonds, then isn't it ultimately true that new money is being created and then placed in the economy somewhere? So I think taking that view of straightforwardly of, okay, these are two different ways that currency can be created and distributed, right? In a different way, the hard distinction between monetary and fiscal policy starts to break down and you start thinking about, okay, well, to what extent is it useful for the government to create and spend money? To what extent is it useful for the central bank to create and lend money into the economy? And to what extent is it useful to remove money through taxation instead of this view where, okay, fiscal policy is constrained by taxes and then monetary policy is not? This, I think, is more helpful in unwrapping that puzzle.
So Derek was saying maybe it's hard to draw a hard distinction between monetary policy and fiscal policy, especially since they're two different ways of achieving kind of the same thing. So I'm going to start by drawing a hard distinction between monetary policy and fiscal policy. So the central bank, the Federal Reserve, is a bank. That means what they do is they swap one kind of asset for another kind of asset. Generally speaking, what banks do, if you go to the bank, they say, we will take an IOU from you. You owe us $10,000 and we'll give you $10,000 in deposits. So you owe us $10,000, but we also owe you $10,000. You can withdraw these $10,000. So they've swapped your liability, your IOU of $10,000, with something that other people will accept as payment. The Fed does the same thing. They take in treasury securities, so debt that's issued by the United States government, and they swap it for base money. They swap it for bank reserves and cash, that kind of thing. So whenever the Fed is creating money, what they're really doing is they're kind of swapping one form of money for another form of money. They're expanding their balance sheet on both sides. They are buying a new asset, which is the treasury security that wasn't on their balance sheet before, and they are issuing reserves. They're issuing base money in order to buy that asset. So their assets increase and their liabilities increase. It's kind of a both sides of the balance sheet thing. And that's what banks do. They're not going to issue liabilities. They're not going to print money without buying something with that money. So they're swapping these two different kinds of money. Fiscal policy, on the other hand, when the government issues debt, when they issue a treasury security, they're also doing a similar kind of swap. They're issuing a new treasury security onto the market, they're issuing the liability, and then they're receiving the base money as an asset. So it's kind of the mirror image of what the Fed does. Now, what's special about the government is that when they spend, the asset goes away. So the net result is that we're left with an expansion of the government's liabilities without an expansion of their assets. That's where you can really see the money creation in play. It's not happening on the side of the Fed. It's happening on the side of the Treasury. And the Fed is merely using their balance sheet to fiddle around with the balance between the different kinds of money that are out there in the economy. So monetary policy is generally not going to add new money to the economy. They might replace one kind of money with another kind of money, a kind of money that's easier to spend, that kind of thing. And that's important. But the Fed is not just expanding its liabilities indefinitely, whereas the actual government is. The government is in negative equity. That's what it means for the government to be in debt. That's what it means for the national debt to keep growing and growing and growing. The deficit is the rate at which the government is expanding the liabilities side of its balance sheet. The initial operation of borrowing, it's just a swap, just like the Fed does, the mirror image of it, but then the spending removes that asset and you're left with the liability. So that's a distinction I like to draw, a concrete distinction that I like to draw between fiscal policy and monetary policy. Now, the question is that Bethany asked, what are the constraints that the government is facing collectively? And something we talk about in here a lot is the price stability constraint. So money has to have a stable purchasing power in order for the markets to function efficiently, right? So the way we have it set up now is the government, the fiscal authority, they do what they do. They spend and they tax and they allocate resources for the benefit of society, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then whatever they happen to do, the Fed has to respond in a way that achieves price stability. As Derek was getting at, the government is ultimately in control because the fiscal authority isn't facing the price stability constraint. It's the Federal Reserve. It's the central bank that's facing that constraint. So if the fiscal authority isn't spending enough money, then the central bank has to do all these machinations in the financial sector to get the price level back up, to prop up consumers, that kind of thing. So that's a difference. You could imagine the responsibility being reversed. You could imagine a world in which the central bank does its thing as a central bank. All they're doing is swapping these two different kinds of money. And their responsibility is to keep the financial sector stable. They want interest rates high enough that you don't have asset bubbles or something like that. And then it's up to the fiscal authority to maintain a stable price level. And they do that using taxing and spending and stuff like that. I think this is more kind of like the MMT view. The MMT view is, well, the Fed should just keep interest rates at zero. And then it's up to the fiscal authority to ensure that prices are stable and that kind of thing. We don't have runaway inflation and all of that. So it's really kind of the responsibility has fallen onto monetary policy to maintain price stability. So that means that the fiscal authority is the dog and the monetary authority, the Fed, the central bank, is the tail. The Fed really has to follow what the fiscal authority does, but the roles could be reversed. But notice that there's really three things that need to happen here, kind of collectively among the whole system. There needs to be allocation of resources for society. There needs to be price stability. And there also needs to be stability of the financial sector. And I would argue that the one we've given up in all of this is stability of the financial sector. With that thought, let's go to Austin.
I'm sure you've done one, but you should do another one on MMT and just a whole 2 hours on the differences between CMT and MMT. But I was going to say originally that it reminds me of a game of bridge, right? Because in bridge, you have your bridge partner, you're not allowed to actually communicate and tell them what hands you're holding. So you have to sort of surprise them by playing the hand and bet that they'll respond correctly, you know? So it's a weird quasi-independence that we've got. And I mean, there's a lot of situations like it, like you mentioned, with the Supreme Court is quasi-independent of the government, and there's a good reason to do that. But with the central bank, I'm not sure. And the other thing I wanted to say is, so there's the one way to think about with in terms of the basic income is, you know, who's going to administer it? Will it be the central bank? Will it be the treasury? But there's also two other options. One is the tax office, right? Like, especially if you have a negative income tax structured one, or which again, it doesn't really matter if it's a negative income tax or it's a basic income and you also have progressive taxation, right? Like, there's a similar sort of outcome. And in both cases, it makes sense for the tax office to do all the counting, right? To have all the numbers about someone's income in one place. Or there could be a new authority created. Like in Australia, we've got this thing called the Fair Work Commission, which is like unions, employers, government, whoever else, right? And they all get together and they negotiate the regular increases to the minimum wage, right? And so you can have a similar process for the Fair Basic Income Commission or whatever like that. And then, yeah. And so again, basic income kind of ends up straddling the two to some extent.
I'm on board with everyone who's saying, you know, maybe we need a separate agency to manage the basic income, because you kind of want it to be calibrated to a level that's optimal for the economy. And that's a pretty straightforward thing to do. You're not like making decisions all the time. You just have to kind of follow an algorithm. And that sounds a lot like monetary policy. But spoiler alert, I don't think of basic income as monetary policy. I think of it as fiscal policy. And the reason why is because of the balance sheet thing I was talking about. You are adding new money to the economy. You're not swapping one kind of asset for another kind of asset. So that's monetary policy, swapping one kind of asset for another kind of asset. Now, of course, basic income has to do with money. It's adding money to the economy, but that alone doesn't make it monetary policy. Now, if you imagine a world in which we have our normal fiscal authority and we have our normal monetary authority, and then we have a separate basic income authority that's responsible for calibrating the basic income, then you can get the basic income up to a high enough level that you can stabilize the financial sector. So then you can achieve the three goals of price stability, financial sector stability, and allocating resources for society. The question is, who is responsible for what if you have these three agencies? And you can put them in different orders depending on what your preference is. For example, you could say that the fiscal authority is responsible for allocating resources, and then the Fed is responsible for keeping the financial sector stable, and they put the interest rate wherever they want it to be for financial sector stability. And then maybe the basic income authority is responsible for price stability. So they have to calibrate the basic income high enough that it's compatible with the optimal interest rate and it's compatible with the optimal fiscal allocation of resources. You can kind of change the order of who gets to do whatever they want to do and who has to respond to that. That's an interesting thing to think about. But I certainly put basic income, if we're categorizing what kind of thing it is, I put it in the fiscal policy category because you have that expansion of liabilities without a corresponding expansion of assets. And the Fed is really doing their bank thing where they're swapping different kinds of government liabilities. Let's go to Bethany. Go ahead, Bethany.
What I had to say goes back to your initial comments. You were talking about how the Fed switches one asset for another rather than creating new money. And I guess just to make sure I was following, you're talking about how like they might pay dollars for a treasury bill, or they might give a treasury bill and get dollars, things like that. Yeah. So I guess what I was thinking of, though, is another way that I often think about them as kind of like creating money in the economy is by controlling the interest rates. And then that affects how much credit other people create. And so credit is in a sense both an asset and a liability, but like it also seems to expand the spending. So it's a way in which like I think of them as kind of quote, that's more the way I would think of them as like creating more money, is by encouraging the banks and whatever to loan more. So can you, I guess, speak a little bit to that?
So I think the biggest thing is the expansion of liabilities that are exogenous to the private sector economy, exogenous to those private markets. So the government is expanding base money and there's a liability on their balance sheet, but there's no corresponding liability in the private sector. And it's true that private sector agents do this kind of thing too. People spend on their credit card and that increases their liabilities and they're not really doing anything to add to their assets. Like this is a real, you know, phenomenon that happens in the private sector as well. So that's kind of how money is created in the private sector. And then the counterparty to that money creation, the one doing the lending, is the bank. So for the government, it's the central bank. For you and your credit card, it's your credit card issuing bank, right? And the credit card issuing bank is still expecting to get repaid. So your liabilities are still an asset on their balance sheet, but maybe your total net liabilities are increasing over time and you're just paying back each one as it comes due, that kind of thing. That starts to look more like the government. So the government is you, and the central bank is your bank. And you create money, and the government creates money. And the banks are the ones who say, okay, we're going to take your money and exchange it for our money, money that other people will accept. Let's go to Derek.
So I really endorse your prescription and also just the general idea that it's probably very most convenient to describe basic income as fiscal policy. If, even if we were to talk about a scenario where the Fed has the responsibility of paying it out, that, you know, you could call a monetary policy relative to what we do today, but it's really just like you've given a one fiscal lever to the central bank. You've granted them that authority. That's all fine. I do think, though, that a lot of, you know, what everyone can't help but talk about in these discussions is not only sort of like, well, what's the best arrangement with the system we have? It's much more abstract. People are looking for what's possible. Like what are the fundamentals of how this works? And it's in that sense that often I find it useful to go out a level and talk about currency issuers, like, and to sort of imagine that the Fed and the government are, that's sort of just the internal workings of one thing that we could call the currency issuer or a currency issuer. And the important questions are like, well, ultimately, what are the effects on the economy that that currency issuance has? And so I find that useful because I think people, the obstacles we get into when we start talking about, well, what's the optimal arrangement? I mean, like Austin pointed out, there's a lot of different ways you could do it. You could have the tax office do that, pay out the basic income. You could have a separate basic income authority. And I think the reason why there is that flexibility is because the natural forces that put the Fed in a position to perform monetary policy are similar to what puts the government in a position to perform fiscal policy. Relative to us, these are currency issuing institutions compared to our daily experience. And so I do think that I feel like there's a way to very simply describe an economy where a currency issuer is issuing out basic income because it's the most efficient way to optimize private sector production. It's issuing the appropriate amount of money into the economy. It's calibrating the economy that way. And then from there, you can say that same institution is, well, okay, is there a problem with there being too much money? Do we need to remove certain money or increase money in certain sectors of the economy? Well, you could think of them taxing the money, removing the money directly. But then if that doesn't work, maybe there's a more elegant method where you can alter the rate of how much money is being lent in the private sector. Maybe you can encourage people to lend less or to save more money. And that's actually just a more efficient form of taxation. And now we're just looking at, okay, is the currency issuer, whatever it's made up of and whatever we want to call it, whether it's a bank or a government, is it issuing currency in a good way, in a way that's appropriate for the optimization of real resources that we have and for the sound management of the currency. That's a very simple model that I think was easy to communicate to people in a way that sometimes, you know, going into the nitty gritty of how the current system works, you know, is not. That said, if we're talking to economists, it's pretty much essential. It behooves us to be able to go into that detail on monetary and fiscal policy. Otherwise, you come off like you're just describing a world that doesn't exist.
I think that's right. And I think something that's special about the arrangement between the government and the central bank is that the government doesn't just have a bank that it can go to and borrow from. The government has a bank that can buy up, it can issue as much debt as it wants onto the market. And if the market for the debt isn't there, the central bank will buy up as much as is appropriate, right? So if you're taking a loan out from a bank, you're borrowing directly from the bank. Now, the government is borrowing from the market. There are businesses that borrow from the market as well, but there's not this backstop for corporate debt. Or maybe now there is. You know, if those markets are having trouble in COVID times, the Fed is actually acting as a banker for the debt markets in general. But this is, you could say the currency issuer issues the basic income in the sense that they're deciding how much money to spend in the economy and they can borrow as much as is appropriate to fund the basic income. You or I were a little more constrained in our borrowing. So if I wanted to issue a basic income, I'm not necessarily going to find a bank to turn my liabilities into currency, or I'm not necessarily going to be able to find a market to buy my debt. And that's partly because the market for my debt is not backed by a bank that issues currency. So I think the concept of currency issuer is useful. And we can think of all banks as currency issuers, kind of as you were getting at. You know, we spend deposits in stores, regular bank deposits, and that's currency to us. It's not base money, but it's as good as base money for our practical purposes as consumers in the economy. So we take our debt that nobody knows about, nobody cares about, it gets validated by the bank and swapped for something we can spend as money. And the government is doing the exact same thing with the central bank or with the market that's backstopped by the central bank. Let's go to Chance.
Yeah, this is a bit of a tangent from that, but I'm kind of interested in this question too. You said in the past that you think there's only one way to implement a basic income, and that is to print money effectively. Am I paraphrasing that right? And if so, then I guess maybe what you were saying, you and Derek just went over my head a little bit. Doesn't that fit in with the role of the Federal Reserve as it is? That's kind of what they do, is the printing money stuff. So it surprises me that you say it should be a fiscal policy project, the basic income.
I would say that no, it does not fit in with what the Federal Reserve does now, because the Federal Reserve is only printing money, they're issuing liabilities in exchange for other assets that they purchase, right? They're not generating new stuff, right? They're expanding the balance sheet on both sides. So they're buying the treasury securities with printed money, right? But from the perspective of the private sector, no money has been printed. One kind of money has been swapped for another kind of money. It's really the fiscal authority that does the money printing, in terms of if you're just looking at the total balance sheet of where the liabilities are accumulating without assets also accumulating. I think Derek was right that if you have the Fed do the basic income, then what you're doing is you're kind of giving them a fiscal responsibility. You're having them do something that normally falls under the purview of fiscal policy. Now, I certainly agree that we probably don't want the basic income subject to the whims of Congress or something like that. So you might want to split out that aspect of fiscal policy that's kind of algorithmic and straightforward into its own agency. But I'd still kind of categorize that under fiscal policy in terms of how the money is created, because you're issuing new money into the economy rather than just swapping two different kinds of money. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. But it still leaves on the table, I guess, why you think it is that like only printing money and not like taxation is how you should go about implementing a basic income.
So this is maybe a kind of a semantic issue. I like to say that anytime the government spends money into the economy, they're adding money to the economy that wouldn't otherwise be there. They're printing money anytime they spend. If they happen to be taxing money from some other part of the economy, that's okay. They're destroying money somewhere else, right? There's no reason why these two things have to line up. So I would say that all government spending is really a form of printing money. And then if you net it out with taxes, there might be a net amount of money printing because you destroyed some money and created some other money. But I tend to think of all government spending as printing money. And in terms of implementing the basic income, regardless of whether you happen to have paired it with a tax, the basic income is still the same thing. The government is spending new money into the economy and distributing it evenly among consumers. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll keep thinking about it too. Thanks.
Okay, perfect. Let's go to Eddie. Go ahead, Eddie.
Somebody mentioned MMT a little bit back, and I want to say that, you know, the thing that MMT gets correctly sometimes is that the limit on spending is productive capacity. I think that's entirely correct. And then I think that the curious thing that happens is that after many MMT theorists say this, then they go no further along the route of understanding productive capacity. There's a question here as to why the economy has excess productive capacity in the first place? Why would that happen in the economy? And I think that is a very key question. And if you understand that question, then you really understand the entire dynamic. I would suggest that with fiscal and monetary policy, that if you look at the beginnings of both of them, 80, 100 years ago during the Great Depression, both of them are a little bit borrowing focused. And so you could think of fiscal policy as, Keynes at this time is saying that aggregate demand is not stable, by itself. It's not self-stabilizing, that it can be too low. And that can cause, a depression or a recession in the economy. And so fiscal policy would be, the government making up for, inadequate aggregate demand by borrowing and spending. And then monetary policy would be, the central bank trying to make up aggregate demand by lowering interest rates and thereby encouraging the private sector to borrow. I would argue that this kind of borrowing focus has kind of worked its way through the last 80 years, and we're now at extreme excesses of both government borrowing and private borrowing. And it's like we're actually using the wrong tool for the job. And if you understand balance sheets, that's a very interesting thing to look at. I'd argue that we have too much borrowing in the economy and not enough money. So, Alex and I have different frameworks, different, definitions of the two. But I would argue that the distinction between base money, Federal Reserve money, things which are technically liabilities, but really do not ever get extinguished the way debt gets extinguished. So debt to me is debt because you both borrow it and then you also technically return it, after a certain period of time. Of course, the government gets around that by rolling over the debt and then borrowing again to make up for returning other debt. But I would argue that what the economy needs is, base money liabilities of the Fed, which are assets of everybody else that, exist and there's no possibility of them ever, going away. They are just there to hold up the economy. And that is what they should be doing instead of using debt to sort of do their job and ending up with instability as a result.
So it's an interesting semantic question, right? Like if you have a form of debt and you're guaranteed to be able to roll it over forever, is it then not debt anymore? So that's kind of how we can think of the Fed's base money that they issue. It's debt that is never going to have to be repaid. Now, the treasuries that the government issues, if they can roll it over forever, that's also true. But maybe somewhere in our minds, we think, oh, there's a possibility of default or something like that. It still has this mechanism built in where it has to be paid as it comes due, even though the total volume of it is growing over time. And we have been able to kind of roll it over perpetually. I think that's a semantic distinction. What's not a semantic distinction is that the economy needs a certain amount of base money in order to function. And it needs a certain amount of treasury debt in order for interest rates to get where we want them. And maybe it doesn't have to be treasury debt. Maybe it could be, instead we could pay interest on reserves or something like that. Now you're turning bank reserves into T-bills, into something equivalent to T-bills, and they never have to be paid back. So maybe you don't have to worry about the possibility of default or something like that. But my feeling is that treasury bills are close enough to kind of this perpetual debt that we don't have to worry too much about the distinction. And monetary policy is just about getting the right balance between treasury bills and base money so that you can get interest rates in the financial markets where you want them to be. And I think, Eddie, you would probably agree with that. You just don't necessarily like using the label debt to apply to base money. Is that correct?
Well, actually, there is, I just agreed with MMT on inflation in one form, but I would add, and I think I differ from Alex currently on this also, that there is also the possibility of hyperinflation, which is different. And I would actually, a different dynamic, it does not stem from from kind of overtaking your productive capacity. It stems instead from a loss of faith in the currency. And I would argue that, having the, that dynamic in particular is a reason not to conflate or think of government debt and money as the same thing. I mean, if you wanted to, like, if the government wanted to, they could just declare T-bills are money. They no longer pay interest rates, and we are going to directly have the Treasury directly issue money. And if they were to do that for the purpose of UBI, I would support that. I would agree with that. But, you know, again, I think the there is, you know, when you say that it's a treasury bill or a bond, you know, based on the historical definition and the historical dynamics, you're essentially confusing people. You're still saying that you're going to pay it back. But I would say issuing money is like, we're creating this money. It's going to create spending in the economy, and it's never going to be paid back. It's just going to circulate. It will never be, you know, never needs to be paid back. And, you know, if you get those two linked up too much, you run the risk of people saying, wait a second, is the government going to be able to, you know, pay their debt back? Are they going to be able to do it without suddenly, you know, issuing a great deal of money suddenly? And, you know, it can generate a capital flight out of the currency. It has, you know, numerous times in history in different countries. And that's something you want to avoid.
Okay, yeah, I think this is where people say it's where the perspective of the Fed printing money comes from, because the people who think the Fed prints money are imagining that the Fed is issuing money to buy things that aren't money, right? So if that's your perspective, if your perspective is that treasury securities aren't a form of money, then it looks like the Fed is printing money and buying those treasury securities. If you think of treasury securities as a form of money, and you think of base money and treasury securities as just two different kinds of debt, two different kinds of money, liabilities issued by the government that have slightly different properties, and the Fed is swapping from one to the other, then it doesn't look like the Fed is printing money anymore. So Tommy is asking a question in the chat. So he says, Alex, you've mentioned that banks perfectly balance their balance sheet, but what role does interest or discount play in that situation? Doesn't that create an imbalance over time? And in that case, the central bank could implement a basic income via an asset, call it a citizenship share or something that pays interest over time. So the interest is important in the banking business because that's why banks are in the business of banking. You know, private sector banks, the interest that they receive on their lending is how they profit, right? So the idea is all the banks are both lending and borrowing at the same time, but the interest that they pay on their borrowing is less than the interest they earn on their lending, and then they pick up the spread. With the Fed, it's similar. The Fed is technically not supposed to go negative on their balance sheet. And if they earn any extra profit, that profit goes back to the Treasury. So the Fed, they issue liabilities that pay no interest, bank reserves. And then they hold as assets Treasury securities that do pay interest. They're not generally going to have a negative equity, or they're not going to accumulate liabilities, because they're doing the same thing that the private banks are doing. They're not doing it to maximize their profit per se, but it's kind of structured the same way. Now, the question is, does it create an imbalance over time? And for, in the case of a private bank, yes, and that imbalance is called profit. In the case of the central bank, the answer is no, because they remit all their profits to the Treasury. Now, the second part of the question is, could they have an asset called a citizenship share that pays interest over time and just have that interest be the basic income? And I think if they did that, they would be violating their rule. So now they'd be issuing a liability that paid more interest than they're receiving from the assets that they hold. Technically, balance sheet wise, you know, you can do anything, right? But that would be kind of a subversion of what we typically think of as monetary policy. And it would be perhaps just another way of just kind of a roundabout way of implementing fiscal policy through the central bank. Let's go to Austin. Go ahead, Austin.
There were three tabs I had open. One was, Derek used the phrase fiscal lever, for that UBI would be a fiscal lever if the central bank had it. But it would also, what I'd actually put my hand up to say was that it would be a monetary lever, right? So if the fiscal authority, if the government has it, then it's also a monetary lever. So it kind of, it has effects both ways. And it's sort of, but in the sense that all fiscal spending is a monetary lever, right? So the point is basic income is a new lever. It's another lever that we could have. And my broader point is, I think that this conversation bleeds over into the question of democracy and politics a bit more broadly, because it's about, you know, people have this idea that we should have an independent central bank. I'm not sure what it shouldn't actually matter, right? Because if you have an independent central bank and an elected government, and they're both working from a correct reading of reality, then everything's going to be fine, right? But people don't have there probably isn't a single correct view of reality. You know, the world doesn't flatten down perfectly into theory, right? So we have to sort of, there are times when the divergence becomes too great. So in Ecuador, where I lived for 4 years, when Rafael Correa was president, it's basically if some heterodox economist like Stephanie Kelton became the president, right? Like, have had a completely radical departure from the previous government's economic approach, from the World Bank, from everybody, and actually incorporated the central bank into a sort of super ministry of economy development and planning, right? Which was controlling infrastructure, spending, welfare, everything, which he was running. And, you know, it worked. That's the thing, right? Like, if it hadn't worked, it would have been a terrible idea, but it did work. And I think that, you know, there's this idea, well, if we let our elected politicians control the basic income or you know, fiscal policy, monetary policy generally, rather, we will have this disaster. And it's like, well, then it sounds like your democracy isn't working very well, right? Like, the problem is elsewhere. If you can't trust your politicians to do the sensible thing, then the problem is not about where the levers are, because they're going to appoint someone else who does the wrong thing to the central bank anyhow. And so, you know, like, I think the ideas discussed in this group a lot of the time, they're kind of the economic policy of a rational world, but then the other elements of the institutions would have to be rational, right? And one more analogy I wanted to say is it's a bit like a fish tank, right? Like, you got all these tubes coming into the fish tank is the market where we all, you know, swim around and, you know, eat our, you know, and someone's putting in the food and someone's operating the lights and someone else is operating, you know, the air bubble thing, and someone else is operating the filter, right? Like, it might make sense, like a giant aquarium, right, to have a person doing each of those things rather than one person managing them all, but you would want them to be in, you know, transparent and open communication. This kind of double bluff game where one hand pretends it doesn't know what the other one is doing doesn't really do us any favors, right? Like, so and then it doesn't matter, like, you guys saying, oh well, do we create, like you've said before, if we create the money up front and then the central bank comes along, or the central bank creates it and it's interest-free, blah, blah, blah. All of that's a bit like sort of details. It's like one of those magic eye paintings. You got to, if you stand back and let your eyes go blurry, you actually see the whole picture. Whereas if you try and focus on any, you know, all the little details, you sort of kind of maybe...
Basic income is certainly a lever. And if you're using it to keep the price level stable, it can feel like a monetary policy lever, because that's what we're used to monetary policy doing. But I really think the defining characteristic of monetary policy is that you have this banking operation where you're just swapping two different kinds of assets. And basic income is not that. So I think of it as a fiscal policy lever, and maybe as a fiscal policy lever that we would want to keep separate from politics. I like that you brought that up because, you know, it's the issue of populism, right? If the politicians are subject to the whims of popular opinion, and if popular opinion is influenceable by people who want to grab power or something like that, then yeah, that's a problem. And you're right that it also represents a failure of democracy, right? If populists who have bad ideas can kind of control the government. If the people control the government and get it to do something really stupid. So yeah, I mean, I think there are limitations to democracy, but there are also problems that you run into if you give up on democracy entirely. So it's a matter of finding the right balance. It's a matter of how do you get the people to elect the experts, or to have a government run by experts who are actually going to do the things that are in the interest of the people, even if it might not be the specific details that people actually ask for. So there's always this balancing act, this high wire act with democracy.
I think if democracy is not working, it's usually a problem of not enough democracy, not too much. And I don't think I think I'm actually arguing against that sort of, I don't like using populism as a slur, right? Like there's a good populism sometimes, right? Like there's populism where people express their interests and the government responds to that, you know, like in third world countries, right? You'll often hear very wealthy people in these places where people are starving, describing it as bribery of the population. Oh, they're just voting for him because he'll get them bread. And it's like, yeah, that's what you're supposed to do when you're the government, is make sure your people aren't starving, right? And they're voting for the guy who's going to represent their interests. And I think it's different in the first world. And like a democracy has a lot of problems, but I don't think actually that the people having too much of a say is that. I think it's the opposite. It's a deficit of democracy. But we're complicated with economics. The question is complicated because I think the experts are wrong, right? So you've said, well, we get people to elect the experts, but in the case of economics, the sort of the experts that are produced by the university system mostly don't like this kind of talk, right? They don't really like the whole I don't want to give too many examples or anything because it'll be a mess, but you get the impression that the experts think this kind of thing is crazy, and that the talk that we have about MMT is considered fringe, and then the discussions in this group are sort of a further fringe from that. And in most cases, I would be like, well, shut up and listen to the people with a degree. Like when it comes to climate change science, I'm not really interested in hearing people's theories about how actually, you know, the sun's solar flares are diminishing or whatever, and it's going to be different, right? Like, I'm kind of like, well, you know, go get it published in a scientific journal and then I'll pay attention, right? But a lot of the ideas we're discussing here haven't been published much in mainstream top-end economics journals. And so why do I think there's a difference there? The main reason is because, you know, you look at the results. Like, you can look at the projections that were made by the central bank and then compare them to, the climate projections that are made by climate scientists and see, like, well, their ones are playing out. Their science looks sound. You know, temperatures and bushfires are increasing in line with the worst case scenario, right, that they outlined. Whereas then you look at the projections for employment or inflation or whatever from the central bank or the treasury, right, then they both come up with the same wrong answer, even though they're nominally independent. They're both getting it wrong in the same direction. So it's tough because, in a sense, Steve King has a line, though. He says, ordinary people know more about economics than experts. Because if you ask an ordinary person, do money and banking matter in the economy? They would say, well, yeah. Surely that's one of the main questions of economics, is money and banking, right? Whereas economists like to sort of push it to the side and say it doesn't really matter as much, which I'm not sure how true that critique is in terms of the language that they use, but it seems very true in terms of the thinking.
Economists do like to ignore money and banking. They like to see money as a veil that merely facilitates the real goods for goods trade that's going on underneath the surface. And to some extent, that's true, right? Money is there to facilitate trade among a giant, large-scale economy. But there are certain other things that need to be true in order for money to function properly. And that affects the real economy as well. Like all the prices can't go down at the same time or up at the same time, or the money stops working. So the fact that you have that limitation, you know, it limits what markets can do in aggregate in terms of, you know, you can't have all the markets clear by all the prices dropping at the same time. That's just not possible. So markets have to clear by adjusting quantities instead, that kind of thing. And most economists don't really think about that as much. Let's go to Derek.
As far as understanding that political problem, I think that is a problem. I mean, this is how I frame it. You can let me know if you think this is useful, but I'm looking at the Fed and the government as two broken current base money issuers, and they're broken in different ways. You know, ideally, the base money issuer is issuing money, enough money into the economy to make it as productive as possible, to give all the money that the economy needs to do what it does. And it also needs to make sure that prices are stable. Those are the two basic things that need to happen for money to work properly in the economy. And that would be simple enough, but there's a problem with our base money issuers, the ones that are governments, is that their fiscal policy is limited by politics. So politics is whatever the king thinks of that morning, or whatever the Hall of Delegates squabbles about that afternoon. And they all have lots of different things that they want to spend money on or think should happen or think are good ideas. And, you know, it hasn't been the case so far that any one of them have said, okay, well, we should calibrate a basic income. So that wasn't happening. Of course, while that's going on, the economy still needs to function. And what happened was we sort of over time grew a second base money issuer or a stand-in base money issuer, the central bank, and they're trying to keep the economy functioning. And eventually they sort of met in the middle, and we have the world we live in today where the central bank does not have the disadvantage of politics. They have been given the freedom to just sort of use policy as much as they need to just get the economy work, to do that simple thing that we all think the economy should do. Today, we think that's full employment. Of course, we have a different view here, but they've delegated that section off and they've made, okay, you're the money issuer or money manager who's just focused on getting the economy right. And then we'll worry about the political stuff. But their disadvantage is that they don't have fiscal policy, right? They've been freed in one sense, but then their hands are tied in another. And we're currently working out that, like Austin and everybody was saying, that kind of where one hand doesn't know what the other is doing, that's how we sort of solve that problem. It's a way of working that. But the fundamental problem beyond all of that is that, well, we're not actually accomplishing what a base money issuer is supposed to do, which is issue enough money to bring the economy to its full potential. That's not happening. And there's a lot of reasons why it's not happening. It's not just that the way that's been set up. It's also more importantly, the objectives that we all think of in our heads when we're imagining what a productive economy looks like. We think a productive economy is everybody employed. So that's what we've told our delegated base money issuer to do. So I guess this is all just to say politics is an issue. Finding the right experts is an issue. What's also an issue is we need to have the right basic idea. We need to understand, okay, well, what actually makes sense economically? What is it that we all want to do anyway? Can we come to agreement on that? And that's, I think, the main thing that has been missing. I do find that when you talk to people about basic income in the way that we've been talking about it here, you can quickly get gears turning. You can quickly get people thinking about this stuff. And I think that will be true for experts too. I think that will be true for economists, but they have not yet really, it's just not on the radar. If you're in this academic circle and no one has talked to you, oh, hey, have you thought about calibrating the basic income? Your teachers never told that to you. Your students never asked it from you. It's kind of hard. It would be hard to do the right thing. They might be very reliable on an expert level. They might be serving that role very well. And I think many economists do serve that role very well, even though there's many that we like to parade, you know, in the stockade on Twitter and sometimes when we're trying to make a case for how bad economists are. But I do think the primary problem is we haven't really understood what a base money issuer is, what it's supposed to do. Once we figure that out, that simple thing out, we get agreement there, the rest of the stuff will fall into place. It'll just be a question of, well, what's the most efficient way to do it based on the system we have so far? And I think that will be, yeah, something like what Alex was talking about. Basic income is a fiscal policy that corrects this problem.
I like what you just said. And I think it's always going to come down to, you know, the problem that basic income solves. The economy needs a source of spending money for consumers in order to function. And then what do we want that source to be? And once we decide it's a basic income, that there needs to be this kind of even distribution of money that's constantly going to consumers, then we can start to ask the questions, okay, well, what is the machinery behind making that happen? You know, where does the central bank fit in? Where does the fiscal authority fit in? Should we have a separate agency? That kind of thing. And there are people who are experts on all of that machinery who are not experts on basic income. But once those people understand basic income and that the problem you need to solve and that this is necessary for a functioning, efficient market economy and efficient labor market, stuff like that, they'll be able to quickly answer the questions of how you do it, that it's a fiscal policy that increases the liabilities of the government without increasing the assets and all of that. And, you know, the central bank can raise interest rates and stabilize the financial sector. Like, they'll be able to quickly give you the rest of the puzzle. They're missing this one piece that's very simple, which is consumers need a source of spending money and basic income is the most efficient way to get it to them. Let's go to David.
I was following the conversation about more democracy, I think, and economics and democracy and how the two things are sort of looped together. And I just kind of wanted to add to that I don't think that the ideas and economic ideas happen in a vacuum. And I don't think that democracy is limited to, you know, the our kinds of government systems. I think democratic exchange of ideas happens and our lots of different kinds of institutions, you know, Twitter and universities and Zoom meetings and that kind of thing. And there's a political aspect to all of it, and maybe democratic political aspect going on, but there's politicking going on. And I think that if you have just because you have a very good idea, doesn't mean that it's going to catch fire, because there's politics in the intellectual realms and the educational realm and stuff like that. Education is always a political act.
That's a really good point. If you come up with the answer to a lot of important questions, does that mean that people are going to listen to that answer? Not necessarily, right? So then the question is, how do we get the right people to understand basic income and to understand the problem that it solves and to really kind of put it forward? Like even most of the basic income movement, as it were, doesn't talk about basic income the way we do, and they don't understand it the way we do. How do we get the basic income movement on board with understanding the economics of basic income at a more fundamental level? It doesn't have to be everyone in the movement, but at least, you know, the experts that the movement is listening to. How do we get, you know, Andrew Yang on board? How do we get Scott Santens on board? How do we get, you know, like all these big names who have big audiences on board with doing a basic income as a very simple policy that solves a very simple problem of how to get money to consumers, and really being able to at least point to people who understand how the economics of it works. Right now, the basic income movement is kind of rudderless. They don't really have a direction other than more basic income. And maybe that's okay. Maybe they could even get basic income passed, but they don't have this kind of core of expert understanding available to them. Let's go to Richard.
We were talking about how we need to have an independent agency and things like that, but it's sort of like an agency that has been dispensing money to people over a certain age for, I guess it's 85 years now. The thing is that other countries, they don't need people to pay into it, but in America we do, and it's described as a Ponzi scheme and things like that. And it's also liable to political influence. Like the past, like, I guess it's like 6 months or whatever it is, there have been various Democratic politicians that want to have people get their money through Social Security by increasing the amount available to it, sort of like a basic income, but like a virus specialty scheme or whatever you want to call it. Just wanted to say that there's a precedent for an agency that dispenses money to people, but it's not free from political influence anyway.
That's a good point. I certainly think the Social Security Administration is more separate from political influence than just Congress deciding random things. Like, they're set up for a specific purpose. So can basic income be an evolution or expansion of what Social Security is? And that's potentially an option. And politically, you could frame it not as a new thing, but as an expansion of Social Security. And that might be something that's appealing to people that doesn't feel like something dangerous and untested or something like that. Let's go to Eddie. Go ahead, Eddie.
One of the things that was mentioned was the asset liability equality with the central bank. I think it is a good thing to point out that even normal banks do have equity in addition to their assets and liability. I would actually suggest that although the central bank has never had in a positive or negative equity, that if we, you know, set it up so that you have a monetary basic income, you know, going out into Fed accounts everybody has a Fed account, and every month, you know, the Fed, you know, deposits $1,000 into your Fed account, which are liabilities of the Fed, then you could actually break that equation, and you could have negative equity for the central bank.
Sure. So could you quickly define the term monetary UBI for us?
So monetary UBI to me is just the central bank prints money and sends it out to everybody. That's monetary UBI for me. And related to that, the question of what monetary policy means, you know, for me, monetary policy is the management of the currency and the economy, kind of those two things together. Another discussion was about the central bank and treasury projections and how those are off and off. And it's almost like a running joke in the finance in some communities. I would say that one of the things that goes on is that, you know, for historical reasons, the Fed, and it's right in their mandate, they are looking at two economic indicators to drive their activities. So one is inflation and the other is unemployment. And so the Fed is, you know, mandated to make sure that neither of those get out of control, inflation doesn't go up, and unemployment doesn't go down. And those are kind of thought of as balancing each other to some degree. And I was, you know, I started following the Fed way back in high school in the 90s. So I've followed, you know, Federal Reserve minutes for about 20 years. And one of the really interesting things back then in the 90s and the 2000s was watching the Fed in their minutes talk about the danger of inflation and unemployment. And there were about 10, 15 years or more in there where you have, you know, neither unemployment and you also don't have inflation. And so the Fed is like a little bit rudderless, is saying, you know, we don't have inflation, we don't see any inflation, but should we be raising rates to, because they're so low? And they said, it's incredible, it's historical, it's incredible, interest rates are so low. You know, if it stays this low for a long time, maybe, you know, surely inflation will come along. We better raise them, you know, so that doesn't happen. And so you can see that the two indicators are not really working very well. They're not telling you what to do. And I would suggest that a better indicator, you know, based on, you know, understanding of capital and consumption would be things like capacity utilization, things like long-term market interest rates. So like the 10-year treasury bond, especially when the market is setting that rate, and like wealth inequality. And what you're really trying to do is just to get sufficient consumption to activate, you know, all of the productive capacity in the economy. And that productive capacity is very much tied up with how much capital, how much physical capital exists in the economy, and financial capital to some degree.
In terms of the Fed raising rates in anticipation of needing to lower rates later. So, you know, they're like, oh, we got to get rates back up so we have more room to lower rates in the future, that kind of thing. And just raising rates for other reasons than the fact that we're seeing inflation now or something like that. I think a lot of that goes away with basic income. You can imagine that the fiscal authority allocates resources, and then the basic income authority is responsible for kind of getting basic income to where it needs to be, that the monetary authority can get interest rates high enough to stabilize the financial sector. You could even imagine kind of the order going the other way, that the monetary authority just raises interest rates to where they need to be for a stable financial sector. And then the basic income authority kind of picks up the difference at the end and says, okay, well, here's what we need to do to get prices stable, because the monetary authority is not doing it and the fiscal authority is not doing it. They each have their own responsibilities. Monetary authority stabilizes the financial sector, and the fiscal authority allocates resources for society. Now, in terms of whether, I think what you call monetary UBI is just what I call UBI. And if the Fed is doing it, then I would say that's an example of the Fed doing fiscal policy. And I think, you know, we do have economic policy levers that are fiscal policy levers. They're not necessary. It's not the case that all economic policy, all policy that's designed to influence how the economy works, is monetary policy. This is why we have the term fiscal stimulus. This is why we have fiscal policy that's economic policy, that's not just paying for specific things. Go ahead, Austin.
I just wanted to quickly go back to, well, this question of democracy. And so I like what David said, you know, everything's political. That's why I don't like that you're a bit in the blur, but we say we discuss intellectual stuff, not political stuff, because I don't think there's a very neat distinction between the two. But in regards to, you know, more democracy or less, I just wanted to, you know, use one quick real world example. I think that the majority of Americans are supportive of another stimulus check, right? Which would be what, and I think all the experts are mostly in favor of another stimulus check, and probably the central bank's in favor of a stimulus check, and everybody's in favor of it except the political class, who are busy with sort of partisan squabbling and can't get their act together. I mean, I'm not in America, I'm watching from the distance, but if, first of all, is that a correct description of what people think in America about stimulus? And two, wouldn't that be better for the economy that, you know, wouldn't stimulus be better for the economy than no stimulus? And does it seem like the politicians are the last to get that, or what?
I think everybody's in favor generally of more checks. And I think there's a lot of politicking going on behind the scenes that's preventing it from happening. So maybe the checks aren't big enough and then one party decides that they're not going to support that plan because the checks aren't big enough and then no checks get issued, that kind of thing. So that can be pretty frustrating. In terms of the word stimulus, like I'm all in favor of more checks. I just don't like using the word stimulus to describe them because stimulus implies that you're kind of getting the economy going with the hope that it creates jobs and then people can go back to getting their money from jobs again or something like that. You're supporting businesses, that people spend their money to support the businesses pay workers, that kind of thing. You're kind of jumpstarting this economic machine that you imagine works in this way that's backwards from how I like to imagine how the economy works. So I would like to say checks or just consumer checks that give them access. I guess I need to come up with something catchier, but checks that give consumers access to what the economy can already produce for them. So basic checks or something, let's call it basic income and give it to everyone all the time forever, you know? Anyway, let's go to Derek.
Yeah, well, just on that point, I think it really is just getting people to say the two magic words together, basic and income. And there's an enormous resistance to that. People want to call it everything else but that. And, you know, we'll call it stimulus. We'll call it, I think the Pope, when he sort of endorsed it recently, called it the universal basic wage. Like we just, there's a really hard obstacles to getting that in there. But the more that you sneak in the word basic income, because that's what's missing, right? Then that's when it starts to, it's gonna take over. I think I'll go in reverse order. So what Austin was saying about the democracy and politics, like I think your characterization of what's going on in the US is basically accurate. I mean, experts are saying we need more stimulus. The population is saying we need more stimulus. And they are in favor of people getting more money. So presumably if they had unfettered access, they would vote for more money. But then again, you know, it's the divisions and the politics that is keeping that from happening, I have to emphasize, you know, is not just a factor of the political class, people in Congress who can't agree. That disagreement, that unproductive disagreement, I believe anyway, extends all the way down. And, you know, I'll never forget, it's something I'll never forget, when I first sort of heard of basic income and started getting the idea and getting involved in the larger political advocacy environment of that at the time. This is before the pandemic and everything during the primaries. I mean, I'll never forget how divisive and how much sort of resistance I encountered, you know, among people that you would think would be the ones that, oh, they want to vote for, these are the general people. They are good leftists like me and they want the people to be okay. You know, why this was actually, there was a lot of resistance to that from people all across the political spectrum, really all over the place. And so I think this, you know, I would agree with you that like there's this problem where what seems intuitive and what people would want is not getting translated into policy. But I can't in good faith put the blame for that entirely on a ruling class. I mean, I think it's pervasive. We have a lot of different warring priorities, people who are talking about things that, you know, might be important. I mean, we should reform taxes, we should have, you know, healthcare and do all these other things, but there's the way that people are advocating for these things are in a way that creates conflict, where I'm not sure that is necessary. I think there are, and I happen to think that there the ways that you reduce that tends to be what some people would call non-political. You talk about a political issue or an economic issue in a non-political way, where you're not trying to make judgments about which class of people or which group of people or which political party is, you know, the one that absolutely has to win at all costs. The other guys are the bad guys. You just drop that language and you talk about it like you're just talking about the economy, like you're just talking about, you know, a scientific issue that the country is facing. So that's like, politics is relevant. It's really important. But like, I think maybe people aren't defining politically the right way. They'll define politics as a bag that you put the economy and policy and everything into, and healthcare and medicine and all these things. But actually what politics is a system for managing disagreement. It's not how you generate agreement. How you generate agreement is what we're sort of doing now. And so, that's how I look at politics. It's like, well, we need a system for making sure that people who just can't agree have a way of managing that. And so we do votes, we do elections, right? That's better than the alternative, which would be just beating each other with clubs. And so, you know, that's how what I expect from politics. I expect politics to be a system we design that helps, you know, us manage our disagreements, but it's not going to help us. Ultimately, I don't think it's going to what's going to help us get people to agree, whether that's a political party or a broader group of people, to agree that basic income is a good idea. I think that's just talking about it.
You know, when I say that we want to do intellectual discussion rather than political discussion, I'm not saying that there isn't politics underlying kind of everything. It's more like the format of what we're talking about or the goals of what we're trying to get at. We're trying to reach an understanding of how certain things work rather than trying to push an agenda or figure out how to optimize pushing an agenda or something like that. And that is what I think of as more like a political podcast or something like that. Like there are podcasts that call themselves political podcasts that analyze politics from an intellectual perspective. And that's more in the vein of what I'm interested in. And then there are political podcasts and radio shows that are just trying to push an agenda, push a political agenda. So that's what I'm trying to avoid. I'm trying to help facilitate the building of intellectual understanding. Go ahead, Austin.
I'm not saying that, you know, everyone's blameless except, you know, some corrupt elite. Obviously, I just wanted to respond to Derek's thing about, you know, are the problems all in politics? I like the analogy, I think of it all the time, of the ship of Theseus, who's this, you know, ancient Greek sailor or whatever, who is always at sea and, well, the philosopher might have been called Theseus, not the sailor, I don't know. But anyhow, the ship of Theseus is a boat that's always at sea and you've got to change the boards of the boat, the planks of the boat, one at a time. You never get to haul it into a dry dock and rebuild the whole thing from the ground up perfectly. And that's the problem with society, is we're always at sea in the world doing, you know, dealing with stuff, right? There's no time to sort of, there's no bit where you can step on the sidelines and take it all down and rebuild it from scratch. So when you focus on politics, and you know, what Derek said is that politics is meant to be a place where we solve our disagreements. But the problem is, on stuff where we do agree, there's still not action taking place. The problem I'm identifying is, like, so in Australia, there was polling done a few years ago now, it hasn't been done again since, that showed that even the majority of conservatives wanted to raise the minimum wage, right? And right now the conservative government is lowering them, about to say, oh, because of the pandemic, companies can go pay lower than the minimum wage in emergency circumstances, blah, 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 right? And I'm sure that that'll be a negative, that will be not have majority polling support, right? I'm sure that that'll be have a negative net opinion rating, and that a lot of people on the conservative side will agree with progressives on this one issue. And so what happens a lot with politics now is that they don't focus on, hey, what isn't inequality a big problem? They're being forced to gradually. They don't focus on, hey, you know, what? Maybe we shouldn't ship all our jobs overseas or whatever, where there's a popular consensus, and then they'll focus on traditionally things like abortion or guns or immigration, where there's a popular divide, because their business is the disagreement, in a sense, right? Like that's that. And I do believe that you have to look at the outsized power of certain groups in society. So Alex was talking about it. You know, we couldn't call it a stimulus check because the point of the economy isn't to stimulate business. The business is there for us, right? Except this is where the Marxist line comes in. It's like, well, actually, you're just missing what's really going on in society, because really there is a ruling class and they are the people who own businesses, right? And that's why the economy is organized to benefit them, because the more business grows, the more people are, you know, the more wage exploitation occurs, the greater their wealth. They have an investment and it's in their interests for businesses to be stimulated, right? Whereas we just want the businesses to provide us with stuff. And we don't want more stuff than we can have, and we don't want to, presumably don't want to work more than we have to make that stuff. But the group that has an interest in making the economy just like spin like crazy, making the engine run as hot and as fast as possible, are those who make profits, because their profits will go up, right? And so I think, like, what's going on discussing the, you know, creating that broad understanding that Derek's talking about, and that sort of deep understanding that you're talking about with intellectuals, is incredibly important. But I stand by the idea that the political system is a little bit, is one of the most rotten planks on the ship. But anyhow, I would also say that then the media is even worse. And that's why my day job is trying to fix the media. But yeah, that's a side story.
All right, fantastic. Thanks for all the work you do in trying to fix the media. I think it's true that people and businesses try to act in their own self-interest. I don't think it's necessarily true that they always know what's in their own self-interest. So the Marxist kind of perspective that you put forward there, it kind of assumes that businesses know what's best for them and they are, you know, putting forward those kinds of policy initiatives in order to get the maximum benefit. And, you know, businesses could be partly behind it, but what's also behind it is that we don't necessarily understand how the economy works. And that's true of businesses too. My hope is that basic income will help bring more people together politically, including business owners. You know, once it's in place, more and more people might realize that what they want from society is actually starting to happen more and more. And that includes business owners. Even if maybe their previous business failed, they have a basic income and they start a new business that's actually more profitable in a basic income world where consumers have more money to spend. Maybe it's a more consumer-oriented business or something like that. Let's go to David. Go ahead, David.
You're talking about capitalists. You guys are talking about businesses and being sort of an owner class and looking out for their own interests. And I'd come across sort of this idea recently about index funds and index funds being sort of a system to that's buying an equal share of all of the market, essentially, that whatever the capitalization is, you're buying this equal share. And that these index funds sort of took off in popularity sort of relatively recently. And they've ended up being, you know, very quite successful. You know, index funds generally have better returns than people who are, you know, picking stocks and trying to predict which stocks are going to be valued improperly and that kind of thing. They're just buying the market. It seems to be the way to go. And what ends up happening is that the index funds are so popular and so successful that index funds themselves end up controlling a significant portion of the economic capacity. You know, these are, you know, $20 trillion, you know, $30 trillion in assets that these index funds control. And if you look at it from a fiduciary duty of the index funds, you start to see that they have some strange, they may get some strange outcomes. Where, you know, if you're an index fund and, you know, if you own, say, Pfizer stock and you want Pfizer to make as much money as possible off of their vaccine. But if you are an index fund owner and you happen to own a significant portion of Pfizer, but you also own the rest of the economy that's suffering from COVID, it may be in your best interest to bleed Pfizer of all of their profits in order to make the rest of the businesses work properly. And so the fiduciary duty of these index funds end up looking a little bit more like the fiduciary duty of a country, where they have these responsibilities to the broader index and to the entire productive capacity rather than any individual company. And I thought that was sort of an interesting, you know, like, you know, in capitalism, you know, fluke that it ends up being this, you know, a bunch of people's, you know, retirement accounts that control all these businesses.
That's really interesting. I've thought about index funds before in terms of just kind of the systemic risk that they create, because everyone's investing in the same thing. And then you don't really have, if everybody's diversified, then nobody's diversified, that kind of thing. But it's also very interesting. I hadn't thought about the fiduciary perspective of you want the economy as a whole to succeed. You want businesses as a whole to succeed. So if one business profits at the expense of others, then you're going to be against that. So that's really interesting. I wonder how much influence the index funds themselves have over these businesses. And, you know, in terms of how it's set up, on one level, we can think, oh, the owners of all these shares are scattered, you know, the investors in the index funds are scattered across the whole, you know, all of society. But then on the other hand, you do have the centralized point of the fund itself. And do those funds exert pressure on the various businesses that they hold that are really just part of the index? So I want to go to a quote. It'll be our only quote from the article. With a few strokes on a computer, the Federal Reserve can create dollars out of nothing, virtually printing money and injecting it into the commercial banking system, much like an electronic deposit. By the end of the year, the Fed is projected to have purchased $3.5 trillion in government securities with these newly created dollars, one of many tools it is using to help prop up the ailing economy during the COVID-19 pandemic, according to Oxford Economics. I like that they emphasize that what the Fed is doing is they're swapping one kind of asset for another kind of asset. They're buying up government securities with this newly created money. I don't like the emphasis, a few strokes on a computer, you know, money is created out of thin air by strokes on a keyboard. I call that one of my MMT-isms. You know, that's something that MMT people like to say a lot. Oh, it's just strokes on a computer keyboard. What you have to realize is that the keyboard is being used to record a promise. It's just the tool that the Fed is using to convey that they're making this promise. They're issuing this liability and they're saying, okay, we're creating these dollars and we promise that these dollars will be stable, that kind of thing. It doesn't matter whether it's a computer keyboard. It doesn't matter whether it's a pen or these are irrelevant to the actual functioning of money. And money does not come out of nothing. It comes out of a promise. It comes out of the ability of the issuer to fulfill the promise that this is going to be a stable instrument that people can use as money. And it's similar. It's easier to see even with the banks further down the hierarchy because they're promising to exchange their own liabilities for a liability further up the hierarchy. They're promising to exchange your deposits for base money that's issued by the central bank. So these are not coming out of nothing. Agreements and contracts do not come out of nothing. They come out of, you know, do people trust each other and what promises are people making, that kind of stuff. So it's as soon as people start talking about keyboards, I tend to zone out. As soon as people start talking about money coming out of thin air, I tend to zone out. And I think a lot of people do. It comes from something and it's important to acknowledge what that something is. So I just kind of wanted to end on that quote. Let's go around and get people's final thoughts. We're going to go to Richard and then Chance and then Eddie. Go ahead, Richard.
As you always say in this group, that money is a means to acquire the promises of the economy or whatever. Well, for this discussion, each branch of the economic system is trying to best arrange the resources they have at hand and trying to move them into various places and trying to best use them and trying to create the best benefit to the people that are their consumer or that they're beholden to. And whether those people are the poor or the wealthy or whoever has the best, most vested interest in that area, they just try to service them the best way they can possibly do so.
The way I like to put it is that money is the standard way to claim economic output. And if you want the economy to work for the benefit of consumers, if consumers are the ones with the money, then the profitable thing to do is to provide benefits to consumers. Let's go to Chance, Eddie, and then Austin. Go ahead, Chance.
Yeah, I guess I could say a little bit about like the stuff that I was thinking leading into this whole discussion, because I mean, it's just something we keep touching on. So in my and most Americans' minds, fiscal policy is straightforward. It seems like you're just taxing citizens, and in doing so, you get some share of the economy. Like you're getting their share of the economy, some of their share of the resources that are available. So the government can then use that to fund whatever projects they're involved in, say cleaning up the water in Flint, Michigan. And so it seems like the major role I think Boston Basic Income is filling that no other sort of UBI discussion board is filling right now is in clarifying like the alternative to just saying like this common like sort of, oh, well, where's the money going to come from in a sort of naive sense, like that we can't do something like use quantitative easing to sort of shift money around or the way that money represents the value in the economy. And so, yeah, so monetary policy is not straightforward. I'm kind of confused. I'm still confused to some extent how monetary policy interacts with fiscal policy. And so this is all super helpful for that. I guess that's all. Yeah, that's all I have to say then. So.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I guess the way we've been talking about monetary policy in this entire discussion doesn't really answer that question. We just talk about swapping one form of government liability for another form of government liability. And the question is, why would you do that? The answer is that if the treasuries are out there on the market are paying a high enough interest rate, then that affects interest rates throughout the entire economy. It affects borrowing throughout the entire economy. So if interest rates are lower, people can borrow more. Money is cheaper and easier, right? And that influences spending in the economy, but it does it through the financial sector and through stimulating businesses and that kind of thing. Now, what the Fed does is if they are buying up treasuries, that actually lowers the interest rate. on the treasuries because it increases the price. So then when you get paid out, the total amount of extra money that you get at maturity is going to be lower. So the Fed buys and sells treasuries to push interest rates around. So that's kind of one of the main effects, is that it affects the price of treasuries and therefore the yield on them, which affects borrowing throughout the private financial sector. But also, if you are adding more reserves, more base money to the economy when you're swapping the treasuries out, then that creates more plentiful reserves at the same time. That creates more plentiful base money. So that makes borrowing cheaper as well. So there's kind of two main mechanisms there by which it works. The second one that I just said is actually the one that is typically taught in money and banking classes, but it's both. A lot of times MMT people even say it's pointless for the Fed to swap treasuries with base money because they're just swapping one government liability for another government liability. Therefore, it does nothing. Or something like that. It doesn't do nothing. It affects the interest rates, and the interest rates affect the amount of borrowing in the private financial sector, which affects the level of spending and the pattern of spending in the private sector. So that's the transmission mechanism through which monetary policy works. Let's go to Eddie and then Austin and then Bethany. Go ahead, Eddie.
We talked a little bit about productive capacity, and, you know, again, this is something that M&T kind of sometimes mentions, but then I think really fails to dig deeper about it. And I would challenge everyone to take a look at three things: capacity, utilization, long-term interest rates, and wealth inequality. Look those up and look at how from the Great Depression to the 70s, all three of those are in a steady uptrend to a peak in the 70s and then a steady downtrend from then to now. And see if you can explain, or, you know, look online and see if anybody has an explanation for this, you know, empirical phenomenon using mainstream economics or MMT or anything. See if you can explain it. I would argue that capital consumption theory, you know, has a good explanation for those facts, and understanding it also gives you a very good explanation and a very good framework to deal with both, you know, inflation, such as stagflation in the 70s, and also, you know, depression, such as the Great Depression. And I would argue, you know, we're currently also in depressionary conditions.
Okay, thanks, Eddie. So Eddie has given us all some homework. If you want to learn more about capital consumption theory, definitely hit up Eddie. Let's go to Austin, Bethany, and then Derek.
Hey guys, great discussion as usual. I'm actually going to finish with a Zen riddle, if that's okay. There's a young monk or something, and he's studying this text and he doesn't understand it. And he goes to his immediate teacher and says, "I don't understand this. Can you explain it to me?" And they go, "No, you got to go up the mountain to the temple at the top of the hill. And there's a wise old dude there and you got to ask him." So he climbs the mountain and fights the tiger and he gets to the temple. And then he gets there and he says to the wise old monk, he says, "Can you read this text and tell me what it means?" And he goes, "Oh, I can't read. So you read the text to me and I'll tell you what it means." And the guy says, "But how can you be the wisest old monk who knows everything if you can't read the text?" And he says, "The text is like a finger pointing at the moon. And you're still looking at the finger, not looking at the moon." Right? And I kind of feel like when we're arguing some of this stuff about, like, you know, does the government create with keyboards, right? In a sense, you could say that the keyboard is like the finger in this analogy. Like, people are getting caught up in this, like, does the government create it with the keystrokes? And then, so if I can break into the room and like, you know, type a different number in, then the whole economy will be different, right? Like, obviously, there's something bigger going on then. So, like, but I also feel like you're trying to overemphasize and create a sort of realness of money that's not there. Like, the economy is a sort of obligation system that we put on top of the real resources of the world, right? And so you can say that there's a promise behind the money, so the money doesn't come from nowhere. Well, then where does the promise come from? And turtles all the way down, and who gives a shit? It's just crazy to me, because there seems like there's a really fresh new vision that's popping up in a lot of places. Like, there's a guy in Australia called Michael Haynes, who's like, I've met him through a basic income group here, and he's basically described a calibrated basic income as his original idea that he's come up with, right? And you find it, and he's, you know, been working on it 30 years apparently, and you find it in lots of places. You guys, Jeff Crocker, that UBI research place is run by a young woman who seems to like just be getting all of the monetary UBI people in one place. And just that for all the differences, there is like a lot that that group, this circle of thinkers has in common that is distinct from everybody else, right? It would be,
what UBI research place are you talking about that's getting all these people together?
I don't know. They published my one about global basic income, how remittances from nowhere, how global basic income can be free. Your stuff is up there.
Talking about Aliza's website.
That's it. Yeah, put me in touch with her.
Yeah. Awesome.
Right. And it's just like, it's good to remember that like the language isn't that important, that the commonalities of the vision are bigger than whether it's called sovereign money or, the government spending is printing money. We shouldn't fight over the language if there's a deeper agreement there.
I think that's right. And I like that different people are coming up with the same idea because it probably is a sign that there's something to it. We already know there's something to it, but that's confirmation. Go ahead, Bethany.
Yeah, I'm curious about the guy who's been working on it for like, what did you say, like 30 years or something like that? So I'd like to know who that is. Yeah, so good discussion. I think the question when we get into fiscal versus monetary policy of politics and like what kinds of agencies should handle what is always like a really difficult one for me. I sort of sympathize with a lot of the arguments that were made, and it doesn't seem like there are just these trade-offs, and it's not always the best way you handle them. In addition to, they're like necessary trade-offs, and then there's like downright corruption or corruptibility, and those are also issues that people are talking about, or like variants of that with special interest groups asserting their knowledge. I guess the one question I would ask is like, so I feel like, Alex, you made pretty clear like why you see the roles as different and that kind of thing. Would you be able to reiterate like why that distinction is important? Because I think some people were kind of feeling like, well, is it just semantic? Like, why does it really matter? Maybe you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great question. Maybe it's not so important. You can imagine one entity that does all of this stuff and they swap different kinds of government liabilities, but maybe the liability side of their balance sheet is expanding. So you can kind of consolidate those two balance sheets onto one. Actually, if you do that and you actually net everything out, then some of that debt is just money that one entity owes to itself. So anytime your combined fiscal authority, monetary authority wants to swap in some base money for a treasury security, what they're really doing is they're deleting the treasury security liability from their balance sheet and issuing a new base money liability on their balance sheet. I think the reason historically why these things are separate is because banks typically provide a different role from the fiscal authority. And that's true not just at the level of the currency issuer of the whole economy, but it's true further down as well. It's true with businesses that they go to the banks to borrow and that kind of thing. So these mechanisms are normal. And we evolved from a situation where nobody was the base money issuer. You know, the base money was gold, right? So the bank was in the business of doing what a normal bank does, which was to swap one liability for another liability, but it's not the base money necessarily, or they'll give you the base money if you want to withdraw your deposit or something like that. So historically, it kind of makes sense that fiscal authorities develop separately from monetary authorities and why it kind of works that way everywhere around the world. But if you have this base money issuer for the whole economy and the monetary authority and the fiscal authority are so intertwined, then it can make sense to kind of think of them as a single entity that does all of these things in a combined way. You still might, for political reasons, want to separate out certain aspects of it, but conceptually, it could be all one big thing. And that tends to be how MMT prefers to think about the government, that the central bank and the fiscal authority are just two different sides of the government, and it's all kind of one entity doing these different things. Let's go to Derek.
Yeah, I mean, that ties into what I was going to remind or point out, which was like earlier you drew just you made it clear that when you say monetary policy and fiscal policy, you're talking about types of policies as opposed to I think many people when they use those words, they're thinking about like this describes what the central bank does, this describes what the government does, and that can be unhelpful because then you lose that flexibility, and what really matters is the policy. So. That's helpful. I mean, I think this was a good discussion. We didn't get into the article, but that's okay because I think we covered all the really important points. And this is definitely like the hot zone. This is like this whole question about where does the money come from, monetary, fiscal. That's where the good stuff is in this debate. And I definitely think we should remember, right? There's deeper reasons underneath all of this language. And the language is just like how do we most it's an attempt to try to get the most concise explanation or the explanation that helps us look at those baseline fundamentals And the only, you know, I think the only time where it's worth, the reason why it's worth, I think, getting maybe arguing or debating, discussing the language is when imprecise language will get us to think about baseline fundamental necessities that aren't there. And so when there are people who are saying things like, well, the big problem with the system is that it's the money is debt-based. And so when central banks switch over to a cryptocurrency, then finally we'll be able to pay out a basic income, right? Because it's no longer debt-based. We won't have that constraint. Well, when you do that, you know, it's like we could be talking about the same ultimate goal, which is a calibrated basic income. But we've introduced sort of like yet another one more thing that has some political challenge, some new change to the system that would have to be implemented. Oh, we need to change what counts as real money. So it's important to be able to have a view of money and the economy, whether we call money real or imaginary or something. It's important to have a view that can get us to look at those baseline fundamentals and not get waylaid by like a constraint that isn't there, right? Like what actually matters is the consumer spending, the basic income, the productive capacity, right? And what it doesn't matter so much whether we're particular that, you know, we think that the only real money is gold, or the only real money is what the government says is money, right? It's like, well, no, there's something else underneath this called money, and we all know what it is. We use it every day, and that's why the reason I like the CMT view is because it uses the simplest terms possible. We're just talking about money, resources, right? Currency, where we try not to add in larger models than we need. And if we need larger, more complex models, we'll build them, but we should be wary of that.
Yeah, thanks. I try to stay simple. Turns out it helps for getting people to listen and think about the stuff that you're thinking about, that we're all thinking about. I like that you brought up the distinction between monetary policy and fiscal policy. So even as Bethany brought up, you can have a combined entity that does both. Monetary policy is still fundamentally about swapping one asset for another asset with the same counterparty, whereas fiscal policy is about adding money or removing money to the economy, and it doesn't have to be the same person. This was a great discussion, you guys. To kind of sum up, I know Eddie has some differences with me on this. I think it's useful to think of basic income as a form of fiscal policy. It might make sense to have it implemented through a separate agency because it's somewhat algorithmic to calibrate the basic income to what the economy needs. And there are three main things that we need to achieve through the combination of the fiscal authority, the basic income authority, and the monetary authority. And that's price stability, financial sector stability, and allocating resources for society. So I'll end on that thought. Next week's discussion is going to be about cultural incentives. Why do we feel that having a job is important for our fulfillment? And why is working part of what drives us? Does it have to stay that way? That's going to be next week. We're going to have Bethany on as a featured guest. I'm looking forward to that.